What I'd like to do over the next 45 minutes, and it's going to be hard to do because the Bible is so filled with so many things, examples of what we're going to do, it's going to be tough to do it, but we're going to try. Look at the Bible, and we're going to look at some of the aspects of the Bible that give you encouragement and make you want to go from here and dig into the Bible and find more of these details. So we want to look at aspects of the Bible that make us want to study it more. And we're going to start off by reading a couple of scriptures. We all know these scriptures. First one is 2 Timothy 2:15. It says, "Be diligent to present yourselves approved to God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, handling accurately the word of truth." And then in the following chapter, it talks in 3:16 and 17, it says, "All scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching and reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." So the Bible is what gives us our ability to live. It gives us our ability how to serve God, and it gives us our ability how to become true followers of God. So let's go into this discussion. The Bible itself is an interesting book. And some have looked at the book and said it's a simplistic, a primitive form of writing. But to the contrary, it is probably one of the most sophisticated books. It's full of meaning. It's full of ideas. It's full of inspirations to cause us to look deeper. We live in a society now that has a short span of attention. And that's created by media, social media, TV. Everything that is happening now is quick, to the point, and really doesn't require you to think much. To understand the Bible, you need the opposite skill set. It requires deep thinking, reading over and over, looking for the fullest meaning. Not to say that you can't get an appreciation of the Bible from a simple reading, but true meaning comes from depth. The Bible itself is a form of literature that is quite different from other forms of literature, especially the forms that we are used to in our Western world. The literature we are used to is based on Greek literature. The storytelling is long. There's lots of details. Character description is full. It tells people's thoughts, what they were thinking. Quite often you have, remember in Shakespeare, you have the soliloquies where you know what's deep in the minds. In the Bible, there's very little of that. So what it does, quite often the Bible is sparse on its details. So they say it can't be a great form of literature. But on the contrary, it's written in that way. God has arranged it to be written in that way, that where there are a limited amount of details, so that we can easily put ourselves into that situation. That we can say, I understand what that person was going through. Boy, that relates to my life. So what we're going to go through the next little while here in this discussion is we're going to look at some of these aspects of how the Bible tells the narratives of these historical figures and what we can glean from the details that are brought out as opposed to not telling. So let's start off first. Have you ever wondered why the Bible doesn't describe what Jesus looked like? Or what Abraham looked like? Or Moses? Actually, most of the Bible characters are not described. Were they tall? Were they short? Were they bald? Did they have lots of hair? Were they handsome or not? Very seldom does it tell. But in certain situations in the Bible, it does tell you. For instance, Esau was hairy. Sarah was a beautiful woman. King Saul was tall. These all have meaning. Let's take a look at Esau. Esau was a very hairy person. Jacob was smooth skinned, we remember. And we see the description of that. It actually is quite descriptive of who he was. When you think of something being very hairy, you think of an animal. Esau acted like an animal. He was led by his desires, his passions. He lived out in the country. He did what he wanted. He saw a woman, he took her. When he was hungry, he was willing to sell his birthright just because he was dying of starvation. So he was willing to just sell the blessings that were to come to him for a bowl of lentil soup. He was rash. He did not think of the future. He was in the moment only. The lesson to us as we read that, do we look at our lives? Are we led by our passions? Are we only going about looking where our desires are? Or are we thinking about our eternal destiny? Are we thinking about the moment, or are we thinking about the future? Are we ready to sell our birthright for a quick, transitory pleasure? Sarah is described as a beautiful woman, and that became the catalyst for Abraham making two terrible decisions of telling that she was not his wife, but his sister, because he feared. It showed his lack of trust in God. King Saul was head and shoulders above the rest of the men of Israel. It says he was a tall man, head and shoulders above all. And again, this aptly describes his character. After he became, what happened to him? He became proud and arrogant. He thought himself head and shoulders above all. So much that when God gave him a command to do, when he was fighting against the Amalekites, he was told to destroy the king and the livestock. King Saul thought otherwise. He thought his way was better. He took the best of the flocks and sacrificed them to God. And it is in that story where God rejected him. And when Samuel came, what did Samuel say to him? In 1 Samuel 15:22, he says, Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as in obedience to the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than fat of rams. For the rebellion is as the sin of divination, and presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because of King Saul's arrogance, he committed the sin of rebellion and idolatry, or presumption, which is the same as idolatry. He was rejected at that point. By contrast, we can look at David. He was not a tall man, especially in comparison to King Saul. And when Samuel was sent by God to go anoint one of Jesse's sons to be the next king, the first thing he says to Samuel is, don't look at the outward appearance. Because first thing, Samuel gets there and he sees David's oldest son, Eliab. And he says, surely the Lord will anoint him because he's nice of appearance. He's got a good appearance. And he's tall of stature. The Lord says, no, that's not what I want. I want a man that I can use that will be humble. And that's what David was. He was an average man, maybe even shorter than average, but he was humble. He lived his characteristics. And that's found in 1 Samuel 16, verses 6 through 12. We won't read all of them. But God doesn't look at the outward appearance. He looks at the heart. And it's interesting how characters in the Bible, their characteristics, when brought out, can help exemplify and show us who they were and how their characteristics met. And again, as we talk about King David, you know, he was that average man, but his trust was only in God. And again, in a smaller story, we see that same thing played out when David confronts Goliath. Goliath, the great man who had no faith in God, David, the shorter man who put all his faith and trust in God. Who won? The lesson is very clear here, brethren. If you want to be pleasing to God, we have to be humble. James 4:6. But he gives us more grace. That is why the scripture said, God opposes the proud, but shows favor to the humble. Another aspect in these Bible narratives that is really interesting is that we should pay attention to are names and places. Quite often they help to explain the story and the meaning of the person, of who they were, the situation they're in. We can go back to the story again of Saul and David. It's interesting if you look at their names and what they mean. Again, it fits in who their characters were. If you look at Saul's name, it means, from Strong's 7586, it means asked for. And he was asked for by the people of Israel. 1 Samuel 8:5-7, the elders of Israel come to Samuel and they said to him, Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your way. Now appoint for us a king to judge over us, like all the other nations. This displeased Samuel when they asked, when they said, Give us a king to judge over us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, Obey the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. So the people ask for King Saul, and they get a king. And it's interesting that the king that they asked for, the very first king, turns out to be one of the worst kings, because they asked for it, he became proud. David, on the other hand, from the Hebrew Strong's 1732, means love, to love. And if there's anyone who showed love to God, it was David. His heart was truly set on following God and trying to do everything that he could to please God. He failed at times, but his heart was always set on trying to be pleasing to God. We read in Psalms 116, I love the Lord because he heard my voice and my pleas for mercy. That was his sentiment. I love the Lord. Another interesting example is found in the book of Ruth. We remember Naomi and Elimelech. They're living in Israel and there's a famine in the land. And instead of trusting in God to protect over them, what do? They go to Moab. They come out from under the protection of God. And they have two sons, and their names are Mahalon and Chilion. And we're going to tell what their names mean, but the first thing I'm going to say, if anyone is ever planning on having kids, don't name your kids Mahalon and Chilion. They're the worst names you're ever going to want to name your kids. But they are fitting to the situation we are in. Here they left God's protection. They go to a place of a heathens out of the protection of God in Moab. And what happens? Mahalon and Chilion are mentioned twice in the book of Ruth. They come on as the sons. They get married. And the first thing they do is they die. So Mahalon means sick or sickly. Chilion means to pine or wither away. And these names are very descriptive of what happens when we come out from under the protection of God. Here, Elimelech and Naomi, the fruitage of who they were, their children, were to be under their protection. If they would have remained in Israel, they would have been under God's protection. But when they come out from under the protection of God, what happens to your fruitage? It withers away. It gets sick. It dies. It's a beautiful picture and a lesson to us. If we come out from under the protection of God, will our fruitage be any good? It will become sick and wither and eventually die. Sometimes, though, God can, out of a wrong turn, a wrong way, can also make a blessing of that. Even though Elimelech, Mahan, and Chilion all died, Naomi eventually did return to Israel, and with her, a daughter-in-law, Ruth, came, and she became one of the women in the line of the lineage of Jesus. So sometimes God can take our misfortunes, our mistakes, and turn it to our good. So there is always a silver lining if we return back to the Lord. I've been looking at the book of Jonah for the last while, and I really appreciate that book. It's a fantastic book. It has so much meaning in it. Anyway, one of the things about Jonah that I found really interesting, and Brother Kent said it has humor in it because it does say things in a sarcastic way. And one of the things about Jonah that it does say is, if you take the name Jonah, it means dove. And if you take his father's name, it means faithfulness. And it says, and the word of the Lord came to the dove, son of faithfulness. Well, if you look at the book of Jonah, who's the least dove-like character in the book? And who's the least faithful character in the book? It's Jonah. So it points a finger at him, showing that we need to look closely at what he does and not live that life. But the point that I want to make about the book of Jonah is, after I gave a talk at Sacramento on it, and a brother came up to me and asked me, because I did mention I believe the book of Jonah has multiple meanings, but one of the meanings that does is it is a prophetic book showing the history of the nation of Israel. It's a prophecy of Israel. Jonah prefigures Israel. And that, just real quickly, the nation of Israel was chosen of God. They didn't believe. They thought themselves more. They even turned away from God. Eventually, God cast them into exile. And in Jeremiah, it says, a great sea monster, Babylon, the great sea monster will come and swallow you up and take you, carry away. And again, so it's like the nation of Israel goes into the belly of the fish, and eventually they are cast back out. They're brought back in from the exile. And he asked me, well, what do the next two chapters represent? And I had to think about it, because the first two are quite easy. But the next two, I thought about it. And I really think it's the next one is when it talks about the preaching of the gospel going to the Gentiles. What was the reaction of the nation of Israel? And what made me think about this is, if you remember when God spoke to Jonah, where did he go? He went to Joppa and caught a boat to go away from God. If we turn to the book of Acts, in the 10th chapter, when God is going to call the Gentiles, he sends a vision to Peter, who is also known as Simon, the son of Jonah. And where is Peter? He is in Joppa. And the vision came to him in Joppa, and from there he went and preached to the Gentiles. So I think that kind of helps tie in the second two chapters of the book of Jonah, showing that the preaching will go to the Gentiles, the nation of Israel as a whole will reject that and will not be pleased by that. You know, that's one of the beauties of the Bible. There is so many details, and we can keep to looking and keep looking, and sometimes we can find some interesting, all the time we can find interesting things. And I really think that there's a nice correlation there between those two. Another way that the Bible, another way that the Bible is different from literature, from other literature, and is really inspired to help us, is that it very rarely says what the people did was good or bad. There's times where it says, and that person was evil, or that person was. What it does is it tells the situation and the events that happened in their life and explains them just as they happened. And it lets us determine whether they were right or wrong. And one example I'm going to give is the example of Jacob and Rachel. Rebecca, sorry. I don't know why I got Rachel here. We were talking about this last night, and I kept getting them mixed up. And Rebecca, they decide, Rebecca hears that Isaac is going to bless the oldest son, Esau. So Rachel comes up with a plan to deceive Jacob's father and with Isaac so that Jacob will receive the blessing. And Jacob goes in, he deceives Isaac, he gets the blessing, and Esau does not have the blessing. And yet, when you look through the Bible, is deception acceptable? Is lying to your father something that is right? The commandment under the law says, honor your father and your mother. Yet, we don't see God condemning Jacob or Rebecca. In fact, the blessing did come through Jacob. He became the father of the nation of Israel. In some ways, it's hard to understand. How do we deal with this? We can look at it in many different ways. Was did they commit sin? Was it a deception, or was their faith so strong that they were going to go any way that they could and to make sure that God's promises were fulfilled? Because remember, to Rebecca, God said, that Esau would serve Jacob, the older would serve the younger. And Jacob also knew that Esau had sold the birthright to him. So he should have received the blessing. Or does it show a lack of faith in God because they should have trusted that God would have carried it out? It doesn't say. We have to kind of determine it by our reading. And that's one of the things that makes the Bible interesting. Because Jacob, in this story, and Rebecca, you kind of wonder, which way are they? But then in the next story, when Jacob is fleeing, he's laying on a rock, and he's sees the vision from God, and it's one of the greatest strengths of faith moment that he has. He's promising to do everything to please God. So that's the beauty of the Bible. It's like real life. Brethren, it shows humanity what it's like. How many times in our life, one moment, we're not sure if we're pleasing God. Did we do what's right? Are we in harmony with what's God? And then in the next moment, as we go through experiences, our faith is so strong because we realize God is working with us and we want to please God in every way. We can put ourselves into these situations. I think, you can see the sophistication in the writing of the Bible that every one of us can see. And we don't necessarily may not fit into this story. We may fit into the experiences of Abraham, or we may fit into the experiences of Moses, or the experiences of Peter, or any other experiences in the Bible. People are not always good and bad, or good. They're not only good or bad. We're a mixture of a combination. Bad people can make good choices, and good people can make bad choices. And that's what we have to remember, brethren. Don't beat yourself down when you make a bad choice. What do you need to do? Change your thinking. Now, with Jacob, one of the things that did happen, it did cost him. For the rest of his life, and we talked a little bit about this last night, he lived many times he was deceived by Laban, by his children. So he did suffer a lot because of that. So just because God can work through and allows it to happen doesn't mean there aren't consequences for our poor choices. But one of the things is Jacob's faith continued to grow and grow and grow all the way along. He always continued and he always sought to serve God throughout the rest of his life. Another way the scriptures can be limited in detail is sometimes they don't give us insight to why things happen. For example, why did God accept Abel's sacrifice and not Cain's. You know, we look at it and quite often we'll say, because Cain's was a lamb and Abel's was of the fruit of the land. But the scriptures aren't really truly clear on that. I mean, we understand that because we can read more further along as we read through the Bible and we understand more of God's plan, we can do that. But at that time, it's very straightforward. It isn't brought straight out. But one of the things we can get from that Bible, from that, the events of that, is not so much that God didn't accept Cain's sacrifice, but what did Cain do after God didn't accept it? That's when the choice came. Because Cain could have said, Lord, what do I need to do to be acceptable? Instead, he became angry and he made Abel the object of his anger instead of turning to God and looking for a solution. God said to him, you need to change what you're doing because sin is crouched at the door and its desire is for you and it wants to rule over you. And the word crouch, there's a really interesting word. It means to recoil. And if you've ever watched animals as they're going to pounce on their prey, how they get back and they've got all their muscles just ready to go. And when their prey is there, it's just boom, instant strike. That's what the word means. So the point is that God is trying to teach through Cain and to us by extension is when we give sin an opportunity, it's like a pouncing animal ready to strike. All it takes in us is a little wavering, a little pondering of that sin, and next thing we know, boom, we have succumbed to that sin. You know, Apostle Paul talks in Ephesians 4:27 where he says, give no opportunity to the devil. The devil doesn't need much. He just needs a little. And the other thing that's interesting about that crouching is, again, it ties us back to the very first time man sinned. Because you have Satan disguised as a snake in the Garden of Eden. Again, it ties that animal, you know, like a snake, they recoil before they strike. So making that once mankind came under the power of Satan, we have to be so careful because Satan will disguise himself in any way to deceive us, to cause us to sin. You know, it also makes us think, when's the last time we have been overcome by anger? Overcome by anger enough that it leads us into sin. That sin has pounced upon us and taken us down. Have we got to the point where we put the blame on someone or something else instead of taking responsibility for it ourselves? Brethren, this is teaching responsibility. If we make a mistake or we're going in the wrong way and God is showing us, it's telling us we need to take responsibility. Don't put the blame on someone else. Take responsibility and deal with it. Boy, I really wrote too much here. Yeah, there's so many examples in the Bible that we could just go along in these. The last thought that I'm going to do in the last 10 minutes here or so. The Bible has an interesting style of repeating ideas. Certain thoughts or words continue through the Bible. And there's a few of them that I find really interesting that I've looked at. One of them is, if you get a chance, look at the incidents where it talks about the voice of the Lord as compared to the voice of people. And you compare them and the experiences that come and the things that happen. But what we're going to do is we're going to look at when it uses the word look or saw in connection with the word good or something equivalent to that. So let's start at the very first chapter in Genesis. When God creates, in the creative days when he finishes, and it says, and God saw, and it was good. So when God creates and he looks upon it, he sees that his creation is good. The earth is being prepared for man. It is being prepared in a way that it will produce this place where there is this Garden of Eden, where man, when he is created, will be able to enter into rest with God, into that peace and communion with God. And it is good, he says. And when God uses these terms, it is a wonderful thing. But when humans use it in the Bible, it never turns out quite so good. And we're going to use a few examples here. The first example is Genesis 3, the Garden of Eden. And we're going to read verses 1 through 6. And it says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat of the fruit of the tree in the garden.' But God said, 'Eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden.' But God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" And this is the key verse. "So when the woman saw the tree," "so when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and was a delight to the eyes, and the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit and ate, and she also gave it to her husband, who was with her, and he ate." So here in the very first chapters of Genesis, we have the first usage of "look" and "saw" in the human context. And almost in every case, and in the human, when humans use these words, it prefigures a time of trial or temptation. And as we go through these ones, we'll see that. When Eve looked at the tree, she saw that it was good. She is now taking, instead of seeing how God views things, now turning it around and looking, how do humans view things? She's now looking at it from a human perspective. And what has happened? She looks at this fruit and sees that it is good and a delight. And when they bite of it and eat of that fruit, their eyes are open. And now they have to hide themselves from God because they see they are naked, and they failed the test. God required obedience. He didn't require a lot. He just required obedience. But because the temptation of the tree, the fruit looked good, they could not obey. They rejected God's view of what is good and right, and said, "We know what is better." They fell prey to the temptation of Satan. And through it, we have all the consequences that have come about. Mankind in sin. Though God is going to use it for good, we now live in sin. Brethren, in our lives, do we see this fruit that is kind of flashy, looks really good, a delight to the eye, things of this earth that are so tempting? Or are we looking to God's ways, which are true and right and good? The next, we're going to look to the 13th chapter of Genesis, Lot and Abraham. Remember, Lot and Abraham's herdsmen were fighting among themselves, and there were just getting to be too many of them. So Abraham and Lot come up to this high hill, and they overlook, and they're up looking, and Abraham says to Lot, "Choose wherever you want to go. I'll go the other way." And Lot, it's verse 10 says, "And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw the Jordan Valley was well watered. Everything was like the Garden of Eden, like the land of Egypt." So Lot looks with his eyes and he sees the Jordan Valley. It was a It was a delight to his eyes. He saw the richness, the great grasslands and the trees and the well-watered so that he could provide for his flocks and that. He saw these earthly transitory things, but what did he fail to see? He failed to see that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah and all those lived in sin. You know, Apostle Paul, Peter talks about this. It says in chapter 2 Peter 2, 7 and 8, it says, "And if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his soul over the lawless deeds that he saw and heard." Brethren, he was living in this torment day after day because of his decision, because of the beauty, the goodness of the land. It was like the Garden of Eden. He failed to see the highway, the higher way. You know, are we like Lot? Do we get ourselves into a situation where we see the goodness, and then we get this goodness of this earthly, of the earth here, and we get ourselves trapped into a situation where we can't get ourselves or won't take ourselves, whether we're too proud or unwilling to ask for God's forgiveness, finally to the point where God comes and destroys the situation that we're in and we barely escape. Lot lost everything. There wasn't all he was left was his two daughters. He lost his wife, other members of the family, his herds, his servants, everything that he had acquired. It was all gone. Well, brethren, I'd like to give a few more examples, but I'm just going to give you the scriptures and highlight them to you, and you can look at them yourselves. The next example I had was going to look at was in Exodus 32. Right after the giving of the commandments, the Ten Commandments. And again, the first two commandments were honor the Heavenly Father above all, honor your God, and don't make any graven images. The first events that come after the giving of the law is what happens. Moses up on the mount, the people want a golden calf to worship. So Aaron says, give all this gold, you put it down there, and he makes this thing, this golden calf, and it says, Aaron saw it and made an altar to worship it. So here they again, they come under this temptation to worship this golden calf. And what do? They fail. They see the beauty of that calf, that false god. The next story is in Judges, the 7th chapter, the story of Achan. The people of Israel go into the land of Israel. They're attacking, they're destroying, they're conquering. And God says, when you attack Ai, just destroy it all. Don't touch anything. Don't take anything. Don't do anything. So what happens? Achan takes something. So in the next battle, they're defeated. So they have this event where they finally search down by family, all the way down to each individual, and they come to Achan. And they see that he says, what sin have you done? And he says, I have sinned against the Lord. And Joshua goes, and what have you done? And Achan goes, well, when I was among the spoils, I saw this beautiful cloak of Shinar, and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold. I just couldn't resist. I had to take it. Again, he got caught up. He was tempted by these things, by the transitory things of this earth. He saw them. They looked good to him, and he couldn't take it. And the people of Israel suffered. Brethren, you can continue going through the Bible and you can find many more times these words are put together. And in a lot of the times they are, it gives beautiful lessons of how we deal with temptation, how we are to watch ourselves. I hope that this has helped. I just want to, before I forget, I want to quote, and Brother Obi mentioned it in his service, from Psalms 34:8. I'm going to read a verse. This is how we should look and see what is good. It says, O taste and see that the Lord is good. Brethren, if we look at the Lord and see that he is good, we won't be caught looking at the things of this earth. So, brethren, we look at the Bible. It is a truly sophisticated book. It is written, God has inspired it in a way that should cause us to want to look into it, see the patterns, see the description, see the details, see the lack of details, and take from these things, cause us to look, put ourselves in that situation, want to understand it, and be inspired by it. Read, you need to read your Bible, because the only way you're going to see these things is if you continually read and look at them. Read, listen. Some of these apps we have now, you can listen to the Bible when you're driving in the car. Have it playing. Do that. And as you listen, you'll be surprised how many times you hear these things, see these things. And they start to inspire you and they cause you to want to go deeper. I hope that this has helped, because what the Bible wants us to do is see that we need God. That is the overarching concept of the Bible, that we need God and we need His plan of salvation, and only as we trust in that can we be saved. May the Lord bless us.